Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I think you will find this morning's presentation very timely in today's political climate. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Professor Shana Guderian. Shana Kushner Guderian is Associate Professor of Political Science at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. She received her PhD in politics from Princeton University. Her primary research interests are in American politics, political psychology, political communication, and experimental methods. Her book, Anxious Politics, Democratic Citizenship in a Threatening World, published from Cambridge University Press, explores how anxiety over policy issues like immigration, public health, terrorism, and climate change affect how Americans seek political information, their trust in government, and public opinion. She also studies how terrorism affects societal resilience in both the U.S. and Europe. Her research has been funded by the National Science Foundation, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Norwegian Research Council, and others, and she has been published in journals in political science, sociology, and public health. Please join me in welcoming Professor Shana Guderian.
Good morning and welcome. So thanks for having me. Emily asked me a couple weeks ago to come talk about the shutdown if it were still going on. I said, I hope it's not still going on. Okay. But so the question is, so I'm just going to go through. So I teach Intro to American Politics at the Maxwell School, and I'm teaching that this semester. And I actually started my whole semester this semester talking about the government shutdown because it helps us understand some of the logic of the ways in which government works and sometimes the ways in which it doesn't work. Okay, so the question is really, how did we get to a shutdown? And how do we get out of it? Because as you may know, the shutdown ended 3 weeks ago, but there's another deadline looming on Friday because the shutdown only ended with 3 weeks of funding for the government. Okay, so how did we get here? Just a little bit of background. Federal government agencies need to be funded by Congress yearly. And the budgets for all of these agencies come out of the House. And the Senate can then make changes. And then when it passes both houses, the president needs to sign off on this. And the sticking point for this particular shutdown was over funding for a border wall. You may know that our current president has very strong feelings about immigration, and one of his campaign promises was money for funding a border wall. And the demand that he made for funding the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies was $5 billion to build a southern border wall. Okay. So based on the last elections in fall 2018, the Democrats control the House, and the Democrats as a caucus do not support wall funding. I believe the number that Nancy Pelosi said that she was willing to help fund the border wall was $0. Okay, so we can see we're quite far apart on the amount of money that the government would like to spend on a border wall. Okay, but as we know, in a separation of power system where there are different parties controlling different branches, that means we have to compromise. And the Republicans control the Senate, and the position that Mitch McConnell took on these funding bills was that he would not put a bill in front of the Senate that he was not clear that the president would sign off on, giving the president, who has a veto over the process, the budget process, even though the president doesn't originate budget sources, giving Trump a kind of a bigger role in the funding of these agencies because of his strong feelings on the border wall. Okay, so this lack of fund, so the Democrats and couldn't come up with a number that satisfied the president. Mitch McConnell would not put a funding bill in front of the Senate that would not be voted on by the president. And so these government agencies, it was about a quarter of the agencies, not all of them, which affected 800 federal workers, ran out of funding. Okay? And all of the workers who were deemed non-essential were sent home. They were furloughed. They were not paid for the amount of time where there was no funding for the agencies. And essential worker, there's a couple of classes of federal workers, one of which is called essential workers. Essential workers were told you have to come to work, but you will not be getting paid during the shutdown. Okay. There's also another set of workers who you often may have heard about, which are government contractors. These are folks who don't work directly for the federal government. Furloughed workers, essential workers are guaranteed back pay, but government contractors are not guaranteed back pay. And there are a lot of those folks who, even though they may have thought that they would get paid for this amount of time of shutdown, they would not be. Okay, so there were missed paychecks as of the middle of January that continued for about 5 weeks. Okay, so I'm going to put my political scientist hat on and talk about how political science helps us understand the shutdown. Okay, so politics is about who gets what, when, and how. And there are a lot of things about this shutdown that show the logic of the ways in which our separation of power system is set up, the ways in which interest groups and the presidency are designed to facilitate both changes in policy, but also can stop changes in policy. So what we know about politics is that working together, collective action is very difficult. How do we get people who disagree on a lot of things to work together to, say, fund the government? Well, overcoming collective action problems often requires coordination, both within branches and across branches. And when people disagree, collective action becomes even harder. And it requires paying costs. It requires paying the cost of not getting everything that you want. Okay, and so people have to be willing in a kind of collective action situation to pay the cost of getting less than what they demanded. Or gambling that, say, a shutdown is going to raise your profile enough that you have some more leverage to get what you want, which is a gamble that essentially the president took and lost. Okay, so the Constitution is kind of one of the main players here, right? So the Constitution again says that revenue bills come from Congress and have to be signed by the president. And this separation of power system creates a coordination problem because you have lots of people who have lots of preferences and they have to come together in order to find bills. And the shutdown is just one example of where these coordination problems happen. But it creates a problem for coordination because we have lots of different players, okay? And in Congress, the structure of leadership is meant to help this coordination. So parties develop in Congress in order to actually help members do their jobs better and coordinate. But they also provide this other coordination problem, right? So divided government makes it more difficult when the parties are quite far apart on coordinating over getting action done. And again, this is a position. These positions on border security are probably further apart across the parties than on many other issues. So party leaders are responsible for both their own caucus and for the institution and the needs of their constituents. So they have lots of responsibilities, and party leaders are there both to, again, get things done and represent their constituents, help their members get reelected, but also they care about the institution. And one of the things that Nancy Pelosi has done as coming in as Speaker of the House is say that Congress is, you know, so if we want to go back to this Congress slide, Congress is Article 1 in the Constitution. The presidency is Article 2, and there's a reason for that. Okay, so we have a separation of power system, but Congress comes first in our system. And one of the things that she has reminded the president of is that Congress is an equal branch, co-equal branch of government, and they matter also. So it's not just what the president wants out of a system. Members also have obligations to defend the power of the institution, right? So when one of the things we'll talk about is one of the ways that the president may want to is trying to go around Congress is to use a national emergency or declare a national emergency or use unmarked funding from some of the executive agencies to get his border wall. And he's already talking about this in trying to get funding, because the compromise that the Congress has come up with to fund the border is much less than what he asked for. And so his argument is that he's going to use these other executive powers that he has to get what he wants. Okay. But one of the things that even from his own party is that the kind of idea that the president would use a national emergency to fund a border wall is bad precedent. Because again, it takes Congress out of its constitutionally delegated role in funding government agencies. Okay, so you might be asking, why are we having a shutdown? Why did we have a shutdown when we did?
A temper tantrum.
Well, maybe, okay. I would put it slightly differently, but the GOP had full control over government for 2 years, okay? But think about this, right? So Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan could have put a border wall funding into the budget 2 years ago. Why didn't they? Well, because they had lots of other things that they needed to do, and they needed to spend their capital on other things, like getting a massive tax cut. That was part of one of the other things that they promised to do. And they did not want to spend their capital on a border wall, which is not a priority for most of the members in their caucus and is not a priority for most people in the public. So they basically kicked the can down the road and said, we're not going to deal with this border wall thing. We're going to let the president talk about it. We are going to let him go have his rallies about it. But we're not actually going to put it in to the budget. Okay? Mitch McConnell, whatever you think about him, he is a very savvy party leader, because what he did by saying we're not going to vote on this unless the president says, is he can shift the blame to the Democrats and say they were being intransigent, they don't want to fund security, okay? And the timing of it was because it was kind of a last-ditch effort that the president had to try and get what he considers to be one of his signature programs, okay? So, and why is the president using a shutdown to get what he wants? Well, actually, the presidency has few formal powers, right? If you look at the Constitution, there are very few things that the president actually gets to do. How do presidents gain more power? Well, they use informal powers like bargaining with Congress. Kind of informal powers like bargaining Congress only work if members of Congress are willing to bargain with you and if you have some leverage over them. Okay? So one of the things presidents do in order to, when they can't bargain, if you bargain with Congress, you promise them things, you try and cajole them to go along with your preferences, if they still are unwilling to go along with what you want as a president, you can do other things. And one of the things that the president can do is go public. So this explains why in the middle of the shutdown, the president went on national television to make a pitch for the border wall. Because he used this kind of informal power of what we call going public to try to persuade the public to put pressure on Congress to give him the border wall, the funding for the border wall that he wanted. Okay. The problem with going public is it's actually much more effective for popular presidents. It's much more effective for popular policies. So this particular going public on a border wall, which I'll show you the problem here is this is what Trump approval looks like. This is Trump disapproval over time, and this is what Trump approval looks like over time. And so you can tell, if you didn't know already, that the president is not a particularly popular president. When you're trying to persuade people, popularity actually helps a great deal, okay? So one of the things that the president argued is that what's going on in the border is a national emergency, and that in order to fund the wall, if Congress is not willing to do it with the budget, that there's other ways using executive action. So there, again, there are formal powers that the presidency has, and one of which is using a unilateral executive action. You saw this with immigration during the Obama administration. DACA comes out of unilateral executive action. Okay, that's not something that Congress allowed for undocumented kids to stay here. That's something that was done through executive action. So what Trump is arguing is that I can work with the administrative state to get what I want. I'm going to do this shutdown because I think I can get some leverage out of it. And I think the public is going to come around. Spoiler alert, they did not. But we are going to instead, as an alternative, we're going to work with the administrative state. I'm going to use the National Emergencies Act to declare a national emergency that will give me lots of leverage and lots of money to build the wall on my own. Okay, he's already talking about this as another kind of alternative. Again, we want to think about in a separation of power system how this denigrates the role of a co-equal branch. There's also other ways to use disaster relief or unmarked funds from the Department of Defense, maybe other ways that they're going to attempt to build the wall. I will say that this is very likely to end up in the courts. And so this is if you're kind of looking for efficient ways to make policy, that using unilateral action is not a particularly efficient way. Okay, so parties allow for the organization of conflict. And here we have, again, parties that are quite far apart on this particular issue of border funding. I would say the parties are actually not. So if you look at what the kind of compromise is that the conference committee has come up with on funding for national security, I actually don't think the parties are that far apart on security. What they are far apart on is this very particular thing of a concrete wall or metal slats or the wall. They're quite far apart, in part because it's a rhetorical thing that the president has kind of put a lot of stake in. So the public, as you might know, uses parties to provide them information on where they should take their positions. And partisanship is stronger now than it has been in the recent past. And the other thing that has changed over time is what we call affective polarization. Partisans now identify with their party more strongly than they have over time. And not only do they like their party more than they used to, they actually dislike the other party more than they used to as well. and so this partisanship is actually a really good thing as far as I'm concerned. It helps people know where to place themselves, what policies that they should support. But it also does provide this challenge when you're trying to, again, solve these major collective action problems. So the parties are also there in this particular incidence, the parties are quite far apart on immigration attitudes and are farther apart now than they were in the Obama administration. Partially that's about the president's positions on immigration are moving the Republican Party further toward a kind of restrictionist view on immigration. And partially that's because the parties represent different constituencies who have different racial attitudes and have different preferences over things like security. Okay. So the other thing that is very particular is that the media is playing a role in the parties these days, and there are particular media figures like Sean Hannity, who has very, very strong kind of restrictionist views on immigration that have the ear of the president. And so part of, I think, the difficulty in getting the president to come around on compromise is that the media landscape, particularly on the right, is very against compromise. And there's a lot of pressure on the president to look strong and not compromise when the essence of our political system is actually about compromise. And it makes it difficult to get to actually getting policy done. Okay. There are also interest groups, and actually this is where the leverage came in stopping the shutdown. So there are interest groups who represent the needs of people who have similar interests and identities. And federal workers unions, particularly flight attendant unions, pilots unions and air traffic control unions are one of the reasons that the shutdown ended when it did. Because when air traffic controllers decided they were going to stop coming to work because they weren't being paid, and flight attendants said, we are not going to come to work anymore, and they basically shut down JFK Airport, that's when the president decided, kind of gave up the ghost, that this was not feasible anymore. Because even though actually most people don't fly, the people who do fly are very vocal in our government, and they have a lot of say in what happens. And so when you stop air traffic coming out of like major economic arteries, the interest groups here had a really big effect on kind of shaping the incentives that basically the government had to reopen, okay? So the other player here is public opinion, right? So while immigration attitudes are divided by party, the wall is broadly unpopular in the aggregate, okay? So we have an unpopular president who is advocating for unpopular policy, which was also costing the economy a lot of money and costing a lot of pain on federal workers. And so we're kind of mounting pressure on the president, once we have this shutdown going, mounting pressure on the president and members of Congress to stop it. So if you just ask the question in many different ways, right? Do you favor or oppose building a wall along the US-Mexico border to try to stop illegal immigration? The 59% of people oppose that, okay? And again, the shutdown itself was quite unpopular. And one of the things that you should know about immigration attitudes is that they have grown more favorable toward immigration in aggregate, although the Republican Party has grown less favorable since 2017. Okay, and this is, we can talk about why that is. Okay, and previous Trump immigration policies are also broadly unpopular. So again, using kind of this going public to try and get what you want out of the public wasn't really going to be a very good strategy, because the public doesn't like the wall to begin with. They also don't like intransigence, okay? So again, if you just look at registered voters in October of 2018, this is this question. Now, okay, the difference is that this is favor or oppose. The oppose is in blue, and the favor is in red, and this is by party of the respondent. So you can see, again, why would the president risk doing something that's broadly unpopular? Well, the wall is very popular among Republicans, right? Among the constituents of his who helped elect him, the wall is quite popular, okay? 75% of registered Republican voters in this poll said they wanted the wall, as opposed to 90% of Democrats who said they dislike it. So we see that we have broad differences. In the aggregate, it's quite unpopular, but there is this polarization across the parties. So public opinion was imposing costs on lawmakers who wanted to be reelected, which is how we, you know, the public is willing to kind of let Congress do its work for a short amount of time. But over time, the kind of costs that were kind of creeping up made the costs for lawmakers who wanted to be reelected go up and up. Oh, so this is a cartoon. It says, listen, I know your dream is to be a federal government employee. We're just asking you to consider a career with more job security, like a street performer or a poet. Okay. So the public is playing a role here as well, because who people blame for the shutdown can influence elite behavior. And so if you ask the public whether or not President Trump should compromise on the border wall to prevent gridlock, again, you see overall 56% of people say yes, we should, that Trump should compromise on the wall to avoid a shutdown. So political participation is hard for lots of Americans, even in the kind of our best attended elections. We still only get kind of 50 to 60% voter turnout. And political participation is in protests and things is a kind of high, what we might call a higher cost activity. But organizations can help people pay the cost of participation. by providing information and logistics and security. And so you have been seeing in the last few years, lots of protesting, much more than we have seen in kind of the recent past. And so part of the pressure that the public was putting on the government to stop the shutdown came through these protests and through other means of calling their members and trying to get the public to, again, directly pressure the government to start. So there were some downstream effects of that we're still feeling of this shutdown. Federal workers were losing lost pay for these 5 weeks. Some people weren't able to have their house loans paid because they were through federal programs. People were potentially losing their security clearances if they were missing mortgage payments. There are like kind of these subtle effects of the shutdown that we're still feeling. There was things on lag on data collection. We're coming up to a census year, and the census is getting ready and to do a massive rollout of a count of people, and they were shut down for 5 weeks. So this is going to, for kind of someone who uses a lot of data, this makes me very sad when we have a lag on data collection. Many people saw longer lines at airports. National parks were damaged. So Joshua Tree National Park sustained so much damage in the 5 weeks that they think it's going to take 200 years to regrow some of the trees that were damaged because the parks were still open, but there weren't enough rangers and people to keep it safe and clear. And so people were like four-wheeling through Joshua Tree National Park and all sorts of things. Food inspections slowed. Again, we see TSA workers who are calling in sick at high rates. This was from my kind of my first class. How does it end? So politics is the willingness to come together even when people disagree about the point of compromise and thinking about who had the ability to pay. So I gave some potential ways in which the shutdown end, and you can see I did okay, right? So the presidential path was to declare a national emergency, reopen the government, and litigate constitutionally. That's not what happened. The Congress could have used a veto override, meaning the GOP, there could have been enough pressure on GOP senators, and McConnell would have put a bill on the floor that had 2/3 majority in both houses in order to override any veto that the president would have done. That didn't happen. There could have been a compromise where we got some movement on DACA where the House reintroduces a bill with border security funding that protect Dreamers and gave them a path for citizenship. As far as I know, that is not in this compromise that they came up with this week. So there could have been federal law enforcement, TSA, our traffic controllers all stopped coming to work and national security at risk. That partially happens. And massive street protests when food stamps run out and there's another E. coli outbreak didn't happen. But this one did. The president backs down. He gets no wall money. He lets the government reopen and gets credit for trying. That's what happened. Okay. And giant meteor didn't happen. I'm not ruling it out as a possibility, but that actually didn't happen. Okay. So again, we have 3 weeks of fund. They reopen the government. They have 3 weeks of funding. It's running out on Friday. It appears that they are going to vote today in the House and Senate on a compromise bill that has $1.75 billion for metal fencing and some limitations on detention beds for internal detention for migrants at the southern border. So in fact, this is about 55 miles of fencing for a wall. So the president is already saying that it's insufficient and he's going to use other means to get to more wall. But it seems like the pressure on him is going to be enough that he's going to need to sign off on this funding. And the funding goes through the fall. Okay. So we're going to open it up for questions. Okay.
Hello. How likely would it have been if Senator McConnell had brought the legislation before the Senate? How likely would it have been that there would have been a 2/3 majority in both houses?
I think it's quite unlikely there would have been 2/3 majority Just given kind of the breakdown of the parties in both houses, I think it would have been hard to get enough Republicans in the House to vote on it. I think McConnell bringing something to the floor in the Senate would mean that he had 2/3, right? So McConnell doesn't do things unless he knows he has the votes or unless he's trying to make a point, which is what's happening this week with the Green New Deal. But if he had brought a vote up in the House, in the Senate, he would have known that they had 2/3 to veto override. I think the harder sell actually would have been Pelosi in the House being compromise, getting enough Republicans who have lots of different incentives than Republican senators to not go along with Nancy Pelosi to vote for a bill. What I will say, though, is that prior to in the lame duck session between the December, the Senate actually voted on a kind of a funding bill that would have had more funding than this, and it got broad support. Right, so there is support for more funding than 1.75. But given the pressure that the president has put on this kind of signature, I think that kind of poisoned the well for compromise in the House. And plus the fact that he, in a kind of televised meeting in the White House, said, I will take any credit for a shutdown, right? And so he basically challenged, right, that anything that happened, I'm gonna take credit for, and he did. Right. His approval rating, which was already low, went down during the shutdown. It has rebounded, but people did blame him for the shutdown.
You haven't talked much about the press and media.
Sure.
I feel that increasingly the traditional print and broadcast media outlets have become less discreet about their biases. Would you talk about the impact of the media?
Sure. I actually teach a class on the media. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. Okay, so I think the role of the media here is important, but I guess I'm unconvinced that the kind of traditional media is the player that matters here. I do think that it's very clear that the president is paying attention to only certain media, right? So the whole shtick that he has about fake news is that you should not trust traditional mainstream media, right? There's only certain media that are trustworthy. And he has the ear, Sean Hannity and those kinds of Fox News outlets are the ones that he's paying closest attention to. So I think they're the players in the shutdown. I think the way in which media interacts with the president is there's so much to say about it. I think that they are just now kind of figuring out how to deal with the president, and how to fact check him effectively. I think there's been, the kinds of problems that I saw in the coverage in 2016, I'm starting to see again. I mean, there's kind of this kind of, the press has this kind of love-hate relationship. It's kind of an abusive relationship, as far as I'm concerned, with the president, right? Which is like, they want to cover the presidency because the president is very important in our system, but he abuses them, right? He calls them names, and they need access, and so they're willing to kind of deal with that. And so they haven't. I think it has taken them a long time to figure out how to deal with a president who is not truthful a lot of the time, and that doesn't kind of, that is unusual. And so I think that has been more of a challenge than I think ideological bias, but I'm willing to talk more about that at another time.
Good morning. You talked about two parts of our government, but as I recall from civics classes, the third part.
We do have a third part.
And the coverage isn't great, but I get whispers occasionally of some lawsuits going through the court systems, mainly considering the contract workers who are not getting paid as indentured servants, slavery, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know if you can tell us where that stands and the role of the court in this.
Sure, yeah, so the good question about what the role of the court is in the shutdown itself. So there, there were several lawsuits from federal workers who were working without pay, some of which were under this kind of argument that working without pay is not legal. It's actually not legal based on our labor laws. You can't ask someone to come, you can't demand someone come work and not pay them. So there are these lawsuits, and so they may actually be, they're proceeding because even though the shutdown ended, there's a precedent here, which is if you shut down government without paying people, do you need to pay them damages or is back pay enough? And so I think those are proceeding through the courts. I don't know. It's quite possible that government contractors are also suing. I'm not aware of that, but. So it's possible that I'm not aware of, but it's quite possible that there's also suits because, again, the Congress passed a law that that government workers are going to get back pay, but they have not passed any laws that would say that government contractors would get back pay. So they may, I'm sure there is a lawsuit on to try and get back pay for those contractors.
You've clearly outlined that the founders wanted to establish a system that embraces compromise.
Sure.
I'm not sure they anticipated a president who embodied the tyranny of the minority like this one does. Would it not be possible for Congress to establish a law that said there'd be an automatic continuing resolution after a certain date if there's a failure to pass the budget?
Sure, yeah, so that's a good question, is why they have to renew the budgets every year. It's possible that they can pass a law that says that funding for government agencies resets every year at current levels, and that any changes need to be compromised over. Of course, there's all sorts of issues with that, right, with inflation and other things, but that would actually get us out of these stalemates that are coming. Not only we have seen this shutdown over budgets before, but also on things like the debt ceiling, which needs to be raised every year. The same thing, Congress could decide we are done kind of having a kind of standoff over the debt ceiling. We're just going to say it automatically renews and we can pass legislation. Now, the question is why they don't do that. So I think part of it is because party leaders don't want to give up leverage that they have, right? So there is I think a lot of what Congress does is to try and make its job easier. So it delegates a lot to the executive branch to do. It could delegate this kind of decision over the budget and these decisions over the debt ceiling to its past self, but it hasn't yet. And I think it's because party leaders have decided that this is a point of leverage that they have, and they'd rather not give it up. But it's a good question.
Other than change of control in the House of Representatives, I don't quite see where this is really solves much. It's been a very interesting story and compelling on any number of levels. But barring your giant meteor, we're going to have the same president for almost two more years. And in the fall, we have a sequestration issue coming up where there'll be a whole other basis to battle this. I don't see much resolved by this in the least. It kind of puzzles. I mean, that's great public attention, but a week from now, we'll be thinking about the next issue, and the wall issue is still going to be here.
Okay, so I think I'm generally not optimistic about government, but as someone who's a political scientist, I actually see this a bit more optimistically than that, which is that I do think that this has revealed that the president has way less leverage than he thinks he does. And that we can return to normal business in Congress, and we can find places to compromise because in some ways the emperor has no clothes. No, and I do think this is not to say that we are not going to that sequestration is not going to be a problem. But I do think that the length and the kind of very unpopular shutdown, the length of this shutdown, the fact that it was incredibly unpopular, and the fact that I talked about the flight attendants unions. They are already saying if there's another shutdown, we are going on strike, right? So I do think that this has created a sense of more that civic organizations, interest groups, the public, they have more of a role to play in putting pressure on the system, and that members of Congress know that. They're going to sit for re-election in 2 years, too. And they are already seeing down the game tree that this kind of business is not very popular. And a lot of them are going to have already gotten voted out. And there are already members who are saying we're not seeking re-election in 2020. That's a sure sign that they know something bad is coming in 2020, because they're not even going to kind of stand for re-election. So again, while I'm not generally optimistic, I do think this doesn't solve things, but it does show that this kind of hardball politics is not really effective.
How would you assess Paul Ryan's leadership during the time he was running the House?
I think Paul Ryan had a hard job because I think keeping together the Republican caucus is not that easy. I mean, the reason John Boehner resigned is because keeping together the Republican caucus in the House was not that easy. So in terms of party leadership, I think he had some challenges. I think he was also kind of trying to figure out how to deal with the president, who he didn't necessarily agree with on many issues, save kind of tax cuts, right? So they got the tax cuts that they wanted. I also do think that being in the opposition for years makes it harder when you get into the majority, because you then actually have to do what you say you've wanted to do for all of those years. So one of the things the Republican Party said for all the years of the Obama administration is we are going to get rid of the ACA. We are going to get rid of Obamacare. And they come into power and oops, turns out that's really hard, because people, while they didn't like it when it passed, it is now more popular, right? And so the challenge for a kind of, again, whatever you think of Paul Ryan as a person or his positions, he had a challenging job, which was to try and get this party, which has these major divisions within it, to then govern and do things that, again, the public didn't really want. The public didn't want these tax cuts. They're pretty unpopular. They also did not want the repeal of the ACA. And some of those, the tax cuts passed and the repeal didn't. And so how are they getting rid of, they're kind of chipping away at the ACA by executive means. And so they're doing that kind of slowly rather than in this big, way.
What do you think about congressional members being punished for actions, for comments, for things that they've punished internally by their party for actions or comments that they've made many years ago?
Are you talking about Steve King? Is that what you're talking about?
Among others, yeah.
Among others. Okay, so I think that kind of the leadership of parties is there to both serve the party and benefit the party and to serve its members. And so to the extent that one of their members is damaging the party, it's their obligation to punish that member, right? So Steve King has for years made racist comments, right? The way in which he won election is to talk about immigration but what did he do? He eventually went into the New York Times and said, "What's so bad about white supremacy?" And it's very hard to walk that back if you are the leadership of the party, right? There's just no way to deny that anymore, right? And so to the extent it has now become costly to the party to look like you are okay with racist members, I'm gonna set aside some things, then you can use all the powers that you have as party leadership to strip that member of their leadership. Now, they can't make it, I mean, they could try to make him resign, but then they could run someone against them in a primary. there's all sorts of other ways they can punish their members. But I do think party leaders make a kind of, they make a calculation of how much any one member is costing them, their party brand, and they use the kind of tools that they have in order to punish those members in order to help the brand and the institution. You seem like you don't accept that as an answer. Your face is skeptical.
If he's popular in his district and he's representing the feelings of his
district.
Okay, so the question is, if he's popular in his district and if people in his district voted for him for his racist views, shouldn't we allow that in, is the question is like, should we allow that in Congress? I think there is, no one is saying he can't run and that his members can't vote for him for his racist views. I do think it is the case, again, that the institution can say, these are not views that we find acceptable, and so you, while you are here, don't get to have the goodies that everyone else has. Right. I think again, the leadership has both, they care both about the institution and they care about their parties, as well as they care about the kind of individuals that they represent.
And the issue of, I'm going to say one good thing that came from the shutdown.
Okay.
I think the general public looks at their taxes and they respond with government's too big, too inefficient, blah, blah, blah. Get rid of it. The shutdown actually showed people what government does. For the first time, I think it got talked about widely on the press. And maybe the general public will begin to understand what they're really getting for their money.
Sure. Okay. So the point is that the shutdown showed people what government does. So I don't know if you've ever had Suzanne Mettler come in, but you should if you haven't. Suzanne Mettler is a political scientist at Cornell, and she's written about what she calls the invisible state, which is that a lot of our public policy is done through taxes and through these means that people don't see in their everyday lives. And that's very much on purpose. But the consequence of, because government is often unpopular, but the consequence of that is that people don't appreciate what it is that government does. And so when people used to get a GI, when they got the GI Bill, right, when they know they get to go to school because government has given them money for something they did for it, that's really different than getting a tax rebate or a refund or something that's relatively undercover. And so one of the things the shutdown did do is show, oh, like national parks, those are run by the national government. The IRS, while many people don't like the IRS, right, they also give you your tax refunds. And so if they are not working, you're not getting your tax refund. Right? Those kinds of things I do think reveal to people the ways in which government works that is more visible. And I do think that is important.
I just have a joke to share.
Okay.
Related to that,
okay.
A man walks into his house and it's a disaster. Dirty clothes everywhere, dirty dishes. His wife is sitting on the couch. She's eating bonbons. And he says, "What is this all about?" And she says, "Well, you asked me, what do I do all day?" "Well, today I didn't do it."
We're talking about bluster, all the things, the lies. In the meantime, there's a lot of damage being done by our environment. The laws are being rescinded, clean water. Appointments of people like the World Bank now,
mm-hmm.
who is against what they do.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of government destruction. Do you believe, if optimistically things change in terms of leadership,
mm-hmm.
do you believe we can do things about the tax cuts, the harm that's being done, undercover a lot of it we don't see? Do you believe this country can get back to a place that welcomes immigrants, that protects the environment, that educates their kids? Or is it going so far that we're in real trouble?
Okay. So there's a lot there. So I'm gonna start with, I often, like I told you, I teach intro to American politics. And so I haven't taught it in a couple of years. And so I had to change some things this time. One of which was I've never taught about norms before. Right. So norms are informal rules that government relies on, that we don't have everything written down. Right. We rely on a lot of informal norms to get to function as a society and function as a government. One of the things I've never done before is talk about the ways in which norms matter, because norms, when they're working, you don't see them. And one of the things that we have noted from this current administration is the breaking of a lot of norms. Right. It used to be the case that presidential candidates would allow the public to see their taxes. Or if you had a business, you would, if you're Jimmy Carter, you'd put it in a blind trust. Right. There are no laws that say that you have to do this. These are just things that kind of unwritten rules that politicians would follow. Our current president does not follow many of those rules. He breaks a lot of those norms. And the question is, are those norms really necessary for government? And I do think some of them make government work better, they make society nicer, but the breaking of those norms may have shown us that they weren't maybe necessary in the first place. Maybe they are, maybe they make things better. So that's the norms question. So I do now a whole lecture on norms. So the other question you asked is about the appointment of people to federal agencies and to the World Bank who do not agree with what the agency does. And I would say that's actually kind of a normal thing for a Republican president. No, I'm not joking, which is that to the extent that federal agencies are fulfilling missions that a president does not agree with, they can appoint someone whose basic goal is to undermine the mission of the agency. That is not an unusual thing for presidents to do. You may not like it, but that's not an unusual thing to do, right? So my former colleague Quinn Mulroy is essentially writing a whole book about this, about how Ronald Reagan put people into the civil rights division in DOJ who didn't believe in bringing civil rights cases. That is not an unusual thing. You may not like it, but that is not something that is abnormal. So if you're a president who doesn't like what the agency does, you can appoint people who either slow walk the regulations, or they decide they're not going to follow some of the regulations, they're not going to try and bring lawsuits. So this may do damage in the meantime, right? There's no doubt that climate change is real. Even if it snows, climate change is real. And that not trying our best to fix it is a problem. But that particular thing of like putting someone in charge who doesn't believe in the mission, that's not abnormal. But the last part of your question is, can we get back to a place where we're more welcoming for immigrants? We have kind of different context than we have now. And I think, yes, absolutely. I think what we see is changes in attitudes on lots of issues over time, depending on who's in leadership. And I think one of the pitches that particularly the many Democrats who are already declared running for president in 2020 are going to make their pitches on just these issues, on climate change, they're on protecting the environment, on stronger education systems, on healthcare, right, on immigration. And that when we have different leadership, we see public opinion changing. But one thing I will tell you is actually we also see the other, we kind of this thermostatic response, which is when you look at attitudes about immigrants in the aggregate, they have actually grown more positive since 2017. And partially that's because the responses to the kind of Trump immigration policies is that they have gone too far. They are too restrictionist and some of them are cruel. And therefore, you actually see a move against those and a readjustment. So a lot of what we see in public policy and public attitudes is a kind of is a reaction to the people in power at the time. So if you want to change what is happening in public policy, you have to change the people who are in office, right? So that would be support people who you agree with, send them money, participate, call for them. Make sure that the people that you care about know your positions and how to kind of support policies and candidates who are going to fight for them.
All right, that's the end of our hour. So I'd like to thank Shayna.